afternoon. My name is Christine Owen. I'm the host here on Identaholics. I'm really happy that you guys joined us today because I have two fabulous ladies with us. First off, I have Jamie Dacre. She is from Medible. And I also have Carol House, who is from Terranet. First up, I want everyone to be able to get to know you guys a little more. So Jamie, tell me a little bit about your background, what you do now, and how you got to where you are.
My title at Medible is Senior Director of Privacy and Cybersecurity Services. I help clients basically build privacy programs. Like if an organization doesn't have a privacy program, I help them establish one, or more often than not, it's improving existing privacy programs. And I like to use the NIST Privacy Framework to do that. My background, it's 20 plus years. I know because I'm like so young. It's
weird to say 20 plus years. You started when you were like two, right?
And I was a child bride and like all the things. Like, I mean, Coco's older than me in dog years. So I start off my career in audit. So 15 years in civil service. Government Accountability Office was my first stop, which was more of an accident that was sort of intentional. I've been interned at GAO, I think my junior year of college at George Washington University, and went to Arthur Andersen Barnett College, which at the time I was like, oh, this is it's a Big Five. It was the Big Five back then. And it was like September 11th, and then Enron's getting on up end. So I ended up calling GAO and said, like, hey, is that offer still open? And I ended up there, and that kind of set me on this journey to be in civil service for 15 years. So I was on a cybersecurity and IT team, had a mentor in counsel's office that really taught me like everything about the Privacy Act, including like the legislative history behind it. I just found it like super fascinating and found myself on lots of audits and reviews of federal agency privacy programs and compliance with the Privacy Act and things like that. So flipped over to the operational side. I did a short stint at Deloitte, ended up at the Department of Homeland Security's Privacy Office, which was the office I had just finished auditing at GAO, which was like cool because even as an auditor, like you actually have feelings about like the programs you're auditing. And I always thought it was just really fascinating. This was like the first statutorily created privacy office. So it's cool. I helped them like write their information sharing policy. And then it was like a consulting fail where it's like you like fall in love with your client and then you just end up like, hey, can we hire me? So I went back into civil service and I stayed at Homeland Security for another 9 years. So it was headquarters. And then I went to E-Verify to be the privacy officer there. And that's really kind of like where identity was introduced to me. So I ended up working with NIST a lot, trying to like make our Privacy Act system of records notices kind of accurate and describe really what's going on in my identity. And that's how I kind of got interested in it, got roped into working on digital identity guidelines that way. And
wait, you didn't just get roped in, Jamie. You are.
I'm an author. Yes, that is true. I am the named author on the digital identity guidelines, Reg 3, the privacy requirements and considerations. So that was Naomi Lefkowitz, and it was like Paul Grassi who was like, because I worked with him to write a system of records notice for the Department of Homeland Security's online credentials. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that the notice covered more than just my particular use case. So I remember talking to Paul a lot and getting a lot of information, and then ended up, helping out with the drafting of the digital identity guidelines. And then was at NPPD, which is now known as CISA. So he's the privacy officer there, built that team, and then left government almost six years ago. And then went to small IT services firm where I basically ended up supporting the NIST Privacy Engineering Program and writing the privacy framework, which was an awesome experience. And now that been a little over 3 years now. So
that was like a long-winded introduction.
That's a great intro. Yeah. How cool is it to get to use the frameworks that you've built?
Really, I think my problem is I start off in like kind of the judgy mode, right? Like you're an auditor and you're telling people like all all your findings and things like that. And I said, well, what would it be like to be on the other side to actually have to implement the programs? And then you're like, oh, this implementation, it's so frustrating. Like, And then you're like, there's got to be a better way to do it. And so then getting to work on guidance. So I like to kind of toggle in between sort of the oversight, implementation and guidance roles.
Yeah, I think all three of us have a little bit of that too. So Carol, let's tell a little bit about your background, which is equally as impressive, by the way.
It's interesting. God has a sense of humor. my career. Because I started off in the Army as an Army officer in chem, bio, rad, nuclear defense, which is like gas mask stuff that is super cool, but people don't like it as much when you're in, because getting CS just not a pleasant experience. Which also meant in the striker brigade that I was in operations. So getting to do very cool stuff like our assistant chief of operations, and we were downrange in Kandahar. I switched over to Intel also doing collection management work. So that means like all the assets that watch and listen to people. My job was to help make sure that they were pointed in a useful direction and wrapped in stack priorities. It was so cool. Loved that. Then I got out, did some grad school for security studies. And then my first tour in the White House was at OMB, helping to oversee civilian agencies, cybersecurity, and work with what was NPPD and eventually would become CISA in some of their programs pointed at trying to help agencies as well as industry in better securing themselves. Spent some time on the Hill at Senate Homeland Security, also doing critical infrastructure and cyber policy, and then went over to Treasury. There's this bureau at Treasury called FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. They're the anti-money laundering and countering terrorist financing regulator. And I found out that they had a cyber section. So I went over there because I'd sort of gotten to see from this perspective that like, okay, cyber crime and financial crime have a massive overlap, like a huge amount of cyber crime ends up being either to steal information or credentials to monetize later or directly to conduct the fraud or the crime, the financial crime, and then do laundering for it after. So I was the lead for cyber, crypto, and identity policy there, which was super fun. And then I went to the National Security Council, my second tour in the White House, where I was driving our counter-ransomware work, as well as our work on cryptocurrency, future of money, and digital identity, which was super fun. Now I'm at Terranet Ventures and doing a bunch of work with some nonprofits and think tanks like the Atlantic Council, Georgetown, the Digital Dollar Project, and Third Way's U.S.-China Digital World Order Initiative. So it's just been tons of fun, and it's great. And I'm thrilled to talk to you guys about identity. I just got back from an identity conference focused on identity theft and fraud. So
where were you? Was stuff in Nashville?
It was Nashville. Oh, yeah, it was the Nashville conference. Yeah.
Yeah. But usually you're somewhere else in the world, like Japan or
She's like the jet setter.
Or that's Switzerland. So it's pretty nice. Yeah. So the one cool thing is the three of us, actually with the fourth, who's also a privacy expert, we tend to get together at least every other month, and we have tea and we talk about the issues that we are confronting at work. And we also have tea that as well. We've got a little bit of tea usually when we talk. But the one thing that we have found, and partially it's because the other person who unfortunately can't be here today, is that she, the privacy person, and I had to collaborate together when I was doing security work. And in that instance, we found that there was a really big need for different functions within that whole cybersecurity framework to be able to start working together more efficiently, because really all of these areas are siloed. For example, anti-fraud is 100% siloed from security, which is siloed from privacy. And none of that makes any sense, because we all need to work together. So I'll start with Carol this time, and let's talk about how you've seen an effective way for the different functions under the broader scope of, like, basically just making sure we protect our stuff. How can we better do that interoperability?
Yeah, and that was a huge issue for us when I was at FinCEN, that bureau at Treasury, because there's this core issue where, like, a lot of security functions, fraud and things like compliance and anti-money laundering obligations. This is things like your customer requirements and requirements for financial institutions like banks to monitor transactions looking for suspiciosity and then reporting it to us in suspicious activity reports. And we noticed that there was this huge silo, and it was wild that, like, things that an institution would see were suspicious and maybe file a SAR on, wouldn't necessarily be shared with like their cyber team or with their counter fraud team. And so even if it was detected for suspiciosity, and so there might be appropriate reporting on it, they weren't flagging that like it was suspicious because it seemed like it was an account takeover or a fraudulent account. And so then the measures for those to try to like deny fraudulent accounts to get access to their systems, or integrate like a maliciously known or suspected IP address into their cybersecurity systems to try to prevent them from getting access to their networks. Mm-hmm. So this issue was something that we recognized at FinCEN, which is nice when you're at an institution that has the benefit of getting reporting that can be at the intersection of these things, right? Like that's often where people see that connective tissue that you ladies have talked about, because you guys have served at the nexus of these things. So at FinCEN, we issued some guidance and advisories highlighting this intersection and encouraging that these silos ultimately need to be broken down, and that what you needed to have was a much greater collaboration across the cyber fraud and anti-money laundering functions. And while it hasn't necessarily adopted across the whole financial sector, a lot of institutions, including like very major banks, have taken really good measures to implement better controls. And FinCEN started to see massive improvements in reporting. Like when cyber activity was seen as suspicious and it was touching a transaction, an attempted transaction, like that stuff was now getting reported to FinCEN with malicious cyber indicators and stuff associated with that. And then FinCEN sanitizes those indicators and shares them back out with industry via the FSISAC so that they can better defend themselves. So that's just one example of where I think like it shows the government recognizing it, helping to equip industry fixing some of that problem, and then better equipping government to then help industry more on detecting it, illicit stuff on their networks.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. That's something that Carol and I have been talking about recently. It's how do we help how is it that the government can help private companies be in a position where they feel comfortable with reporting their cybersecurity incidences? Because right now, it seems like they get dragged through the garden and something bad happens, right? So the government needs to make it a safer space, for lack of a better word, for companies to be able to go and report any issues or specific suspicious activity that they see. But it is really important because, as we've seen with something like Scanner Spider, what happens at one company is repeatable, and it happens in every single company. And that's something that we have seen. Like, we've seen multiple companies need the exact same tool to be able to combat some Scanner Spider issues. So for privacy, this is something that Jamie and I have been on a roadshow on for a couple of years now, is the intersection of privacy and security, and how privacy is a very important piece of cybersecurity, and cybersecurity is also a way to accomplish the privacy things that you're trying to accomplish. So you have some really good knowledge from not just from the government, but also from like Fortune, 50 companies. So what have you learned when security and privacy work together?
I think it's awesome when they do work together. I mean, in civil service, like I had the fortune, I think, of being at CISM. I was close with the CISM side, and I think I got a lot more done. I don't think it's a secret, and Craig Supergrams are generally under-resourced. In contrast, I mean, you could argue that CISM's not possibly resourced, but comparing apples to apples budgets, generally CISM has more positions in an agency, in my opinion. So I think the better friend you can be with the CISO shop, the more effective you can be. DHS did a lot of that in sort of injecting policy requirements in the sensitive system security policy. So, you know, it's compliance related, but it's kind of the forcing mechanism to like have visibility in what's going on within the organization. I've seen organizations, I think in Fortune 100, that are siloed, and you kind of see these regular issues where it's like, the security team is moving forward with this, or a product team is moving forward with something that like clearly is going to have privacy implications. And, you know, they're always afraid. I like kind of this phrase, like that the privacy team stood up with the no in innovation.
And, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Phrase. Of course, yeah. I came up with that one.
Yeah, like, yeah, so I feel like I'm the kind of privacy professional that would like to get to yes, but, and kind of help companies strategize on how you can get to yes and how you can build a program that can be compliant with laws, but manage pregnancy risk at the same time. So,
right. And I think that a lot of people, I think you're right. I think a lot of people think of privacy as it's a yes or no function, but really it's a, how do we put guardrails in the process to make sure that people who shouldn't have access to that data don't have access.
And I think it even goes beyond that, because like you were talking about the intersection of privacy and cyber, and I really like the NIST Venn diagram that kind of articulates the intersection. You know, we've got confidentiality, availability, and integrity when it comes to cybersecurity. So obviously confidentiality is that shared privacy objective, but in privacy, there's also like so much more than that. Like strong identity obviously protects privacy in terms of unauthorized access, but when you're establishing an identity, you're collecting a ton of, you know, personally identifiable. I'm censoring myself. Jessica's not all the So when you collect all that information, it also creates risk, you know, and so the risks that cyber doesn't necessarily concern itself with are kind of purpose specification. Like we collect the information for identity purposes, and you don't expect that information then to be used for targeted advertising. Like we've seen companies get in trouble with that before, where they establish multi-factor authentication and then they use that text message to like target you for ads, unbeknownst to the consumer, which causes surprise and probably can result in fines. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that those are all really good points. And I think those are things that, like you said, product owners don't always think through, like, I really need this data. But then once that data goes into some sort of data lake within the organization, other parts of the organization go, "Ooh, that's some good data."
I mean, mission is kind of a real thing, and a lot of things, it's just, you know, it could be honest mistakes, but there are a lot of, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but like there are a lot of legal obligations too with the state privacy laws. You've got data subject access rights, and so think about, you know, if you're copying your data like over to multiple places and an individual requests all the information you have on them, you'd have to have the capability to be able to provide that back to the individual.
Yeah. No, I agree. Oh, yeah.
Like,
So,
Coco agrees.
Coco is such a good girl on privacy. She says, that's exactly how it works.
No.
Yeah. I can't see her. She's off camera going, give me some pet.
Yes. I really love, like, both of you talking about privacy. It's funny. So, I'm coming from a financial regulatory space and also dealing a lot with cryptocurrency stuff. A lot of discussions and issues get raised around privacy, and frankly, the way that they're framed end up, like, what they're really doing is conflating anonymity with privacy. Yeah. And both of you talked about data being critical to privacy, because privacy doesn't mean the absence of data. It means that there is data that's sensitive and critical and important, but that there's some kinds of like protections, permissions, and conditions behind how it should be disclosed or shared. And right. I just, like, those of you were hitting on that in the way that you were talking about privacy. And it's just like why I love talking to these ladies, because they understand what privacy and security are. And a lot of people conflate these things and don't understand the nuances that come in. Privacy doesn't mean the absence of accountability. It, in fact, demands accountability.
Yeah, it's
kind of like a permission
practice principle. Yeah, like, you know, it would be a fair information practice principle. So it's accountability. So,
yeah.
But I'm 100% with you. But people have such strong feelings when they talk about privacy. And so, like, so I was actually talking to somebody who is in law enforcement, and her whole thing was like, she kind of like in her personal life, like, live off the grid. And like, I get like not wanting to engage in social media, but like, she like uses cash and like all these things. And I just thought it was kind of ironic, because it's like law enforcement can track you, you know? But some people really feel strongly that they don't want to be tracked in any kind of capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But and then maybe about the people who say, well, I've got nothing to hide. And like, I don't agree with that argument either.
There's some legislation just passed the House. I don't think it'll make it through the Senate, but it's an anti-central bank digital currency bill. And it mostly was voted on via party lines. There were any Democrats that voted for it and a few Republicans. This legislation that was just passed by the House, it bars any central bank digital currency from being issued by the Federal Reserve, which includes wholesale or retail, which basically means either retail, like something that can directly reach out to consumers, or central bank to central bank. And even the Congressional Budget Office said that it might even prohibit existing digital forms of central bank reserves, which would mitigate the U.S. central bank's ability to currently conduct monetary policy. So I'm glad that this does not likely have any legs on the Senate side. But there was a specific aspect in there about their desire for the privacy features of cash to exist in any digital, like in any future of digital money, which I have feelings around, since I don't think that the exact same features of privacy with cash exist in any cryptocurrency. There are kind of comparable, but not exactly equivalent. It's not the same. Like with cash movements, I can pass $5 from me to you, and I don't need a third party to do it. In cryptocurrency, while they call it peer-to-peer, it does require third parties like validators and miners to validate that that is a valid transaction that gets published to the public ledger. So it may not require like a bank to take the money and move it somewhere. But there's an interesting role that third parties play in cryptos. I don't think it's exactly equivalent to cash. And then also most cryptocurrencies publish to public ledgers, which cash does not. So it actually, in my view, was asking for privacy features in digital money that do not presently exist in basically any cryptocurrency or at least not exactly. So it was interesting that this the first privacy legislation that passed Congress wasn't a consumer focused privacy statute.
I can see that. I mean, I hear your points, but I also feel like from a consumer point of view, like if I want to use cash, I might want to be anonymous. And
yes,
yeah, no, and so I don't think that your privacy should be worse just because you go digital. And like, you're probably not saying that either, but I think that applies even for going digital in any kind of credential, that like, we shouldn't design things such that our privacy is worse. Like, you know, there's like privacy enhancing technologies. Like what's the opposite word of enhancing?
Privacy
reducing.
And I totally agree with you. Like my view is like the irony of like pointing to cryptocurrencies as if they're private when
they're not private. Apples to apples.
Exactly. Like to me, like my voice of like being against this bill was for a lot of other reasons, but on the privacy piece, I wasn't saying that it shouldn't be private. Because in fact, I think that the only way for it to be adopted and with consumer trust would be with private reservations. It's just that it will look the same as with cash.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's where I was like, this would warrant further explanation about
privacy assessment.
Using Jamie's framework is what we should do.
I agree to all that. I think part of it though is, so I agree, and this specific use case is totally different because it's cash, right? Like we're talking on cash or replacing the concept of cash. Although if you digitize cash and then don't have a ledger, then you can't actually go and see where the laundering occurs. So it becomes a bit of a problem. But let's move it over to the security side, right? So I actually was thinking about this while we were talking. FIDO, which was created to preserve privacy, right? So it's a very strong phishing-resistant token that allows for someone to go and log in and for the relying party to know that there is a strong likelihood that that person is the person who has the credential. Not that they're supposed to have the credential. You have to add additional things to it, like identity money, but they more likely than not actually are in possession of that token. But currently, they go into a little bit of FIDO stuff. Currently, FIDO is talking about adding provenance and other things that in some cases, some people who are very into the privacy preserving, they say, well, you're stripping the privacy preserving because you're stripping away the anonymity. And amenity.
It's hard.
It's not hard work.
You know, identity words are like so hard.
They are hard.
Synonymous.
It has nothing to do with what we have in our hands. Yeah. It is absolutely just the words. Yeah, it's hard to say. Which was a very good idea, as was, for example, the whole concept of blockchain and being able to do everything anonymously. But what we're seeing in security is we actually need to have those ledgers. We need to be able to see what's going on in audit trails. And we need to see the provenance of the token that's coming for various reasons, right? So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on where it is. I know that I just sprung this on you, and I'm the one that knows in all of the FIDO working groups, not you guys, but it is something that isn't openly discussed about within LinkedIn. The idea of how do we preserve privacy while, and not anonymity, just privacy while also keeping a strong security posture.
So I think you have to look at retention schedules, and I think you have to look at stakeholders who are fraud experts. And this is one area I felt like I was blind on, not for lack of trying when I was in government, that like, you know, data minimization, you can accomplish it through many ways. One is like having a retention schedule that is reasonable and not like 100 years kind of situation. And so I think you need to have fraud experts that talk about like, what is the length of time that is needed to like, for law enforcement to like prosecute a case?
7 years.
Okay, 7 years. And that may be too long. And so I think there has to be some sort of compromise because I think generally, you know, all these issues are, I think, are too complex for the public to really kind of comprehend. And so I think it's kind of, it's on us to make decisions that sort of balance things like fraud, private, cybersecurity purpose, and privacy altogether. So like, maybe it's not 7 years, but like, I think it depends on the use case. If they for high risk transactions, your retention might need to be a little bit longer, or you kind of have a tiered approach. Like, you know, you can only access the data in certain use cases. I think there are a lot of ways to kind of get through. I don't think it just means that you retain everything indefinitely.
So
you have to have reasonable retention schedules.
I actually really like where you're going with this, because you're bringing up something that I haven't thought of before, and I want to hear your thoughts because you've dealt with this. But when it comes to fraud, right? So anti-fraud measures, the retention that for companies who are working with places that could have fraud, their retention rates are 7 years. They are required to keep all of that PII, all of the identity documents, for 7 years, right? And it's to help investigators. That's the whole point. But quite frankly, if you don't have something started within like 1 to 2 years, are you really ever going to be able to prosecute those people? Yeah, what do you think about this?
I do actually think that, yes, we've seen instances, and trust me, I've been a voice for a while about the challenges that I have with how long it takes for us to bring cases. Often, there's reasons for it. Due process takes time, and it should. Certainly in my world, where like we just brought, like there was a money laundering case against an institution. It was pointing to that and like OFAC sanctions violations. And I think from like 8 years ago. And I like there's, and actually one was from 10 years ago. We have some soul searching to be doing on our side about why it's taking us that long. Because if the point of, especially things like civil enforcement, where the point isn't just to like hold accountable bad guys, but the point is to shape an ecosystem and a sector like the financial sector to be compliant and to mitigate risks, whether or not bringing in, like, whether or not these timelines are actually doing the job that we want to be sector shaping and not sector breaking. Beyond that, then the fact that we do need to figure out how to scale enforcement. Industry doesn't always like to hear that, but actually early and often enforcement normally means smaller enforcement actions and helping to like whip the sector into shape instead of crashing it down on fraud things, which is criminal activity. And this is where like, it's tougher because, I mean, we've definitely seen cases that point to activity that either a crime ring or even an individual have been guilty of years before, but ultimately were to raise to the level of reaching prosecution, it's often got to like be certain amounts and other things. And we're definitely not doing enough to hold accountable the bad guys. Like, I think the fact that we've now stoked a blockbuster movie starring Jason Statham to go after identity thieves.
What?
I watched this going. It's called The Beekeeper, and I watched it going to the identity fraud conference that I just went to, which was also the funniest way to watch that movie, like on the way to an identity fraud conference. And it is exactly what you would get from a Jason Statham movie. So like, it's
lovely.
But like the fact that we got a blockbuster movie that everyone that I know in like a lot of identity spaces were saying, oh my gosh, everyone has to watch this movie. And I'm like, this has risen, that these were the bad guys, the guys that were going after the most vulnerable in our population, is fascinating and demonstrates like we've gotten to the point where society does want us to be able to do more with this. I hear you definitely on the data retention schedules, and there's always going to be this tension with like law enforcement about what is that timeline that should be there, the requirements that we put in place for banks and others to retain information under things like the customer identification program requirements. And ultimately, the biggest investment that we really need to help solve all this is that, wouldn't it be great if we had a digital identity ecosystem where I don't need everyone to be able to hold and retain the information that then could be like, I wish we could publish. I wish we were in a position where we wouldn't do this, but where we could publish the Social Security number list and it wouldn't result in a dime more abroad. Again, don't want to publish that list. I just wish that we were in a position where we had built the identity infrastructure, that there wouldn't be any more fraud because you happen to know essentially an open secret. Like that is what I wish that we could do, is invest in that digital identity infrastructure, which would then enable us.
Great, Dr. House.
Yeah, no, I know. And Jamie has been the data minimization like gospel thinger for a while, and it's totally right. Like, this is how we ended up in exactly the situation of these giant tech companies having massive amounts of data about consumers and us not enforcing these kinds of requirements. And ultimately, none of us, I think, even understand how to redirect an entire economy that isn't based on harvesting people's data. Like, this is why I think Congress hasn't been able to make meaningful progress.
Well, I actually think that there are standards that W3C have put out that actually has figured this out, right? So that what you are basically preaching, which I totally agree with, is the concept of digital wallets, right? So you as a user, as a consumer, you want to have your own data protected. Someone else has to protect it for you because you can't build your own BIPs encrypted module for yourself, right?
Maybe for yourself.
All right, well, I'm going to hire you then. I know I can't do it.
It's okay. Episode 2.
No, we have. We have built it, right? So
we built it. Sorry. Jamie and I are using it.
Verify Rachel, what you explained is essentially what we need in the future. And I am a big preacher and proponent of verifiable credentials because I want to be able to keep my information in a place where I know that only I have access to it and literally nobody else has access to it, right? And then if I want to share my information, I can share it. But I don't necessarily want to use like my identity documents, like my driver's license or my passport, to be able to authenticate myself into something. I need to be able to use a different credential that is attached to that VC to do it, right? So, but also when I'm shopping on a website and I haven't registered in that website before and I need shipping information submitted, I want to be able to use that verifiable credential to pre-populate the stuff because I'm too lazy to type in my address, right? So I think that there are definitely use cases where we can do that. And I totally agree. I think putting all PII or identity documents into a data lake is not the best option, right?
Truth.
Yes. Yeah. What do you have?
Exactly. Wouldn't it be great to render all of those like breached, PII lakes available in the dark net to just render them moot and useless?
That's all so funny. I feel like you're reading my email because you guys were probably all subject to the
email.
That side work that I do for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The dark web agent.
Yeah.
Actually, I got a notification from, I think, whoever the identity monitoring provider is for the OPM data breach. So
yeah, my social security number was found on the dark loan.
I was not alarmed by it. Like 10 years ago, I might have been alarmed by it, but it's like I have multi-factor authentication established. So, you know,
this is the public service announcement.
Have multi-factor authentication. You know, we had an experience this summer in Europe where my spouse's identity was stolen, and it was kind of embarrassing in a way because I felt like I failed as a cyber and privacy professional in some ways because he had used the same password across multiple sites.
He didn't have MFA turned on.
But in fairness, he did for the financial accounts have
MFA turned on. So, yes.
But it was still very anxiety producing because it's like, I know that so the funny thing is, it's like in the digital world, I'm becoming more of a digital adopter because I feel like I do not remember all the things I need to carry with
me. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's that sinking feeling when you like left your purse somewhere, you left your wallet, you know, I mean, it could be the same feeling in the digital world, but.
So the interesting thing about this, and I think that this is really important because I was an advisor on this summer issue, is that one of the things that was stolen, it was stolen because he used a password that was actually in the dark web. He didn't know. So that username password combination was in the dark web. They used it. They did probably credential stuffing. That's my guess. And when they did that, it was a social login that then got into other accounts.
Yeah.
And that was the issue. It was the social login aspect. So for those of you listening, if you have a social login, make sure you protect it with multi-factor and not just a private.
I don't want to reject a family vacation. And by the way, it was only
let's be honest, it was slightly better because that one day that
we were going to get married, we got to rest.
The ladies got a rest day. He got an anxiety-ridden day, but it was a rest day for that.
Yeah, I remember like when my Twitter was hacked and I didn't know that it was because I never use it because I'm just a lurker on Twitter to watch news feeds and things and to see what the what crypto Twitter is saying. Uh-huh. I've just never posted anything, but like someone told me that, hey, you just liked something, and I'd never liked anything on liked something on Twitter. And I went and looked, and like there was a, I will just say, a political group and video, associated video that I liked and had followed that was absolutely not me at all. And I was just horrified and was like, because I had paid attention to that account. So I hadn't turned on in the bank because I created it like way long ago, like in 2014 before I was even in cyber. And I just felt so bad, like working in cyber, like oh my God, I didn't like it because I'd never used that account. And so I just hadn't even occurred to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we all have even as individuals, we have our own cyber hygiene issues.
That, absolutely.
Like the organization. So I was just at a conference for the National Association Public Health Statistics Information Systems, and they had this fantastic presentation. It was the assistant U.S. attorney for, I think, covering Kentucky, and an FBI cyber agent, and they talked about this case. I cannot remember the name of the guy's handle, but essentially this guy had been able to steal credentials for the state of Hawaii's death registration system. Right. And so here's where all the cybersecurity confidentiality, the integrity comes into play. Like the password was simple. The account hadn't been used in 2 years. So the doctor had no idea this was created. This individual went in and created a death record for himself. And the story was that he basically was doing it because, when you have a death registration certificate, it feeds into other government systems, has impact on financial. Like if your wages are being garnished, because you're trying to skip child support, which is ultimately what this guy is trying to do. He's just trying to kill himself off in records. So he faked his own death in records. I'm going to find the link and send this to you guys. And so the agent and the assistant U.S. attorney kind of walked through all the facts of the case, which was fascinating. And there were all these representatives from kind of the state by the statistics agencies. And it just really kind of, for me, drove home that cyber hygiene is really still an issue for all types of organizations and sectors. Like, so the lessons learned there were and when these agencies don't necessarily have the funding to prioritize strong cybersecurity, but there were definitely lessons learned and best practices you probably shouldn't allow an account to exist. You should put it in a suspension or some sort of process, have multi-factor, all these different things. But apparently this individual is also trying to then sell access to other state vital records, things, you can create fraudulent birth certificates, you can create fraudulent death certificates. So to me, it just kind of drove home that cybersecurity is definitely a national security issue. It exists in every single sector.
So what's really interesting is that is essentially the use case, but on a larger scale from bad nation state actors that I have been really rattling the saber about, because what that person did, they didn't steal PII. They got in and they created a record. And what I am worried about the most in national security inside the U.S. government is a bad actor coming in and creating records that are not real, that are fake. Intelligent records, for example, records on when they critical infrastructure, records on how systems are working, things like that. Put additional audit records into the, or delete and add audit records into a SOC, for example, and creating mass chaos. that's like my biggest fear. And definitely, you know, using a password on systems like that is gonna help that bad actor for sure. But it's interesting because from a privacy perspective, do you think privacy also includes adding data or manipulating a person's data and adding something to their record?
Yeah.
Or is it only reading and deleting and taking?
Oh, I mean, I think modification of someone's record, because yeah. I think privacy looks more at like harms to individuals. Like, you know, you've got cybersecurity risk and then privacy risk. I like the NIST definition, and it's basically the risk to individuals. I forget the like full definition, but it's basically privacy risk, you think about it as the individual experiences the direct impact. And that could be a harm related to that's tangible, like economic loss. And then you've got the kind of intangible things like, you know, dignity related harms or embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And that ends up accruing to the organization. So I can see how like, I was scanning through Netflix last night and they had the Ashley Madison.
So
I was going to start watching that. But like, that's an example of like privacy and security, right? Because, you know, not to defend all those cheaters out there, but like, that's pretty embarrassing and heartbreaking for all those families. So like, that's harm there. Like, how do you feel about the website? But that was both a privacy and security situation.
So what keeps you up at night?
Yeah. I know national security nerds like all of us, we're good at dreaming up worst case scenarios. Yeah. And I'll say that I guess some of the stuff that scares me a lot is I like buzzwords. So the convergence of AI and blockchain are really interesting to me.
What?
I know. Okay, so I'm going to start with AI. That like, of course, AI isn't new. It, like if you haven't been using AI either in the conduct of like your own activity or things like compliance, you really haven't been competing at things like finance or the sectors that I've been in. Like AI has been around for AI and machine learning. But what's totally new is like, and first off, like the growth and sophistication of AI just growing, but now the democratized access, this paradigm shift towards democratization and what inherently comes with tech as it becomes more open source and available. This democratized open access to really, really highly sophisticated like compute and AI capabilities and large language models is now making it like almost essentially trivial the ability to circumvent most of the basic fraud measures that we have been telling institutions for years to put in place.
Yes.
So this issue, like deepfakes, and trust me, I am also concerned about the integrity of our elections and like this issue of the fact that we have not built in place the digital ecosystem for tracking and enabling things like provenance of data and information. And there's so much behind all of this because once you start getting into censoring information, you hit the First Amendment every time. So there's really complex issues that challenge the ability to put accountability in these systems. And in systems where we've liked openness, we preferred openness. That was why Section 230 was what it was to help enable the internet to grow like it did. But now we do have both parties being interested for coming for things like platforms and Section 230. While also no one having a viable alternative to improve Section 230. But AI, this like democratized access to really highly sophisticated capabilities.
Yep.
And even though most of them are positive commercial applications, I am excited about AI, have been, my GitHub is hilarious, but I have built machine learning models like and used them in a couple of cases, like whether for FinCEN or for work I did with CNAS on state veterans benefits and mapping them and looking at trends. Like, I love AI. But then there's blockchain, which has the goods and bads that we can get into sometime, including related to horrifying privacy implications.
But wait, let's back up. Yeah. When you talk about blockchain, you're talking about public blockchain.
Yes, public blockchain encrypted. Yeah. Sorry, that's and that's a great point. Sorry, the way that I got introduced to blockchain was exclusively the public ones, and cryptocurrencies were like the everyone excited about this new very, very cool technology that combined blockchain as two words as I knew it, blockchain and cipher encryption,
right,
with like distributed computing, and now you get blockchain as one word essentially. Like, that's a very rudimentary way to describe it. But the, and then they chose finance as their first use case. And I'm like, great, awesome. Fine. So like basically publishing publicly people's financial transactions. However,
which is what Venmo is doing for a while, even though it's not a blockchain, they were doing that.
Yes.
It, also very scary.
Exactly. That was the default.
Like, why is that a default activity? Yeah.
Why do people want
know that I gave you $5 for Thai food?
There's a comedian I like a lot who mentioned, he made a joke about how he was surprised that all these people got on Venmo. He was like, this was for joke users. And I was like, that is not how I characterize Venmo. Let me be very clear that I did not characterize it that way. That was just a funny bit by John Mulaney, comedian. I thought it was a funny bit by him, because I use Venmo and other things. And so it was just funny to me that was a bit that he did, because where the default setting is public. That was interesting. But blockchain as a technology is really interesting. And actually, I think that these two technologies help reinforce each other's best and worst traits in really interesting ways. Because AI is in need of things like auditability, data integrity, provenance tracking.
Yeah.
Blockchain is made for that. The problem for crypto is that the guys who first deployed most of the use cases were deploying it as if it was private and privacy enhancing. And I'm like, that's not what blockchain was made for, to obscure things. Now, it can help provide things like the accountability. Angle of privacy. But it, that's not the way that Bitcoin and publicly publishing your transactions was implemented. So I think that blockchain can actually, if it's looking for a use case, and I think that there have been many use cases that have been explored, some of which successfully and some of which not so much. But blockchain seems to answer some of these calls that AI is seeking. And blockchain's problems on things like scalability, AI can help solve. I think that these technologies have very interesting applications for each other. My problem is that with blockchain, and specifically decentralization, so the most public, the most unaccountable, the issues that come in DeFi of lack of clear lines of accountability, this is where that combined with AI, so scaled unaccountability, are the things that I'm that's the greatest fear that I have. When you have a malicious cyber botnet that is being command and controlled by a distributed command and control node that's not operating on a couple devices or servers, but it's on 1,000 devices around the world. How do you take that down? In Japan, at Japan FinTech Week, there was an event that I did, and live during the panel, I pulled up ChatGPT and I was like, ChatGPT, hey buddy, if I deployed you on a decentralized network and then you started to act or operate maliciously, you got taken over or your code had a vulnerability in it, or it just wasn't written well because we don't write code very well. That's why we have so many security problems. Could I take you down? And its answer was, it depends. And I'm like, great answer. And it said, it depends on how good my security is, how decentralized I am, and how good your authorities are. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's a great answer, ChatGPT. I totally agree with you. So I'll stop talking now. But basically, it's this convergence that I'm like, okay, this is... talking about worst case scenarios. Yeah. This is something that I'm going to keep an eye on. Certainly.
Yeah, I agree. Deepfakes is probably the number one thing that is scaring me right now. And it's something that I feel like we need to re-educate security professionals on, because right now, we think, oh, I see you through a video and it's live, it's on Teams, whatever. It's trustworthy. It's not trustworthy. We have to do checks on the back end. And that's something that we do. With my company, we have to have those checks, and they're very important to be able to detect liveness, true liveness, not there's somebody on the other side. We've also found that in doing our research, we found that the price to get these deepfake overlays to be able to defeat a person, it's not generally you can't defeat AI because we use AI on the back end to do the biometric checking, but to defeat a person, it doesn't cost that much money. It's actually really cheap. And if you are looking for a small investment, small investment to be able to make a lot of money, boy, that's the thing that you do. You go and buy one of these programs. Forget the stock market. Oh, yeah.
This is Jamie's launch into a line of
Jamie is now
15 years in civil service.
She just goes downhill. Hopefully we have a 7-year retention policy for this video. He is gone now.
It's going to be there forever.
No, we don't have a public ledger. I disagree. On the other side, this is actually, I'm gonna get a little personal here. I actually, before I joined One Cosmos, I was never into blockchain. I like blockchain bros came to me like moss to a flame, and I'd be like, yeah, that sounds great. No. Yeah, that sounds great.
I like you being the flame in the scenario, by the way.
Well, it's the brand new. Yes.
Never trusted Ginger.
Yeah.
But at this point, now that I understand how the private and permissioned blockchain works, I realize actually it's not the security measures for PII is so much stronger when you give the private key back to the end user than if you have obviously an open blockchain, public blockchain, not something that looks good. But the encryption within blockchain is so strong.
Yes.
And it's so important to have that if you find the right use cases and build it the correct way, it actually becomes a privacy preserving mechanism.
Exactly. I agree that it's those right use cases, and I love it being used in security things like immutable records.
Exactly.
Supply chain. Like these are the right use cases.
Yeah.
But these are the right use cases.
Absolutely.
And it's not that you can't fix the public ledger issues, because you can with other encryption and obfuscation,
right.
But it's taking, they have to put in place other mechanisms that often they haven't, or they haven't done so in a way that's lawful or enables other types of security issues to be accounted for. And so there's lots of broader issues, but I love leveraging blockchain for other really interesting like enterprise
uses. Yes. And the cool thing is that this is something that's actually gaining traction within the EU. They're starting to realize that for a strong digital wallet, blockchain might actually be the right technology. It's just, how do you build that blockchain the right way to be able to make it privacy preserving and also make it strong in security, which is really important. So the one thing I wanted to end on is we try to do tea every other week, and we, and four of us women, and we also try to have additional events with a lot of women. Obviously, men are also allowed. But why, what is it about having a group like this where it's like only women and cybersecurity professionals? Why is it important? Okay, technically, it's so important. No, why is it important?
Yeah. So I'll kick it off because you two are such an important part of that journey for me. And also, I know Jamie, you couldn't be here.
Yes.
And there's other really critical women in the identity world, like Honey over at
Nis. Absolutely.
And Naomi's amazing. And I'm a part of this. There's an executive women leaders a fellowship that I'm a part of that was sponsored by the women that stood up Fortune's Most Powerful Women list. And their whole, I loved their thesis behind why they launched this was because they didn't want, they were first looking at what this year, I think, was the first year since the early 2000s, but maybe around 2005, that the percentage of women CEOs on the Fortune 500 list went down. So in almost two decades, it's the first year that it's actually decreased.
Wow.
And it's hovering around, I think I'm going to say 12%, but I know that it's in an article online. And so that's us going up for the last two decades. And we're still hovering there. As they were trying to figure out what is this? Is this a pipeline problem? Do we need to cultivate and create more talent? And their thesis is that no, it's not a pipeline problem. There are amazing women. They don't have the championship and the access. They don't have the other people helping to build each other up, find each other's connections, figuring out where those fusion points are to go off and to be able to be given the opportunities that others are. And obviously there's many that are in disadvantaged populations that don't get opportunities. And I'm in the venture space, and the number of women in venture capital is extremely minimal, and especially minority women is less than 1%. It's wild. So I think I've been honored to be a part of this, the Journey to Lead Fellowship, but also and I'm thrilled to be with the most incredible community of women there. But in cyber, a lot of the female leaders that I've latched on to were just the most kind and open with information, with connections, with contacts, in a way that helped me grow. Whether I was getting deeper in a specific matter that I already cared about, or touching something else, and then through people like you, like when I, like, I know I threatened for years for both of you to get into blockchain and crypto.
And it's then really I did it.
Exactly. And also, and we're getting Jamie. Because ultimately, like what I've seen with ladies like you, like I saw a space that was in desperate need of your expertise, and where I was like, oh my gosh, none of them understand how to talk about privacy. They need anonymity. I'm like, oh, all these things need privacy frameworks. And like all these guys need to enhance their security because, oh my gosh, they're getting pwned by like Lazarus Group. Like if Lazarus Group changes from targeting banks and Swift terminals to go after your sector because it's so much easier to target and launder, like you have some soul searching to be doing as a sector. And like, basically I feel that when I see you guys as the answers to them, and it's not because you're inherently women, it's because you're the leading experts in this space that I can point to, as well as many, many others that I try to bring in also. But frankly, like we see that like women need, they need the championship and the access oftentimes more, because there's rooms like where I see that people just won't say the name of the woman who should be talked about, who should have been in that room, just say her name, and it's often not. I see that. And it's something that I've striven for, because I've been lucky to have specific champions in my life who have taught me that lesson. And I've learned that from, and I need to pay that forward and search for it. But I think that like understanding that amongst each other, because we understand those challenges, and then also pushing ourselves and those that are networked to say, this is your moment. I'm looking for a champion. Are you going to be that person? That's not something that we always are raised to be inherently like, you know, pro, like to be supportive of. Like we're often mentors. Being a sponsor and a champion is different than like helping someone grow versus me saying, no, I'm taking you with me into that room. That's not something that like, and sometimes it rocks boats in a way that we're often told, like, don't rock the boat, because like you're competent enough, you're good enough, you're going to be brought along for this ride. But that's not enough. It's not enough anymore. We need to be willing to rock that boat and drag the other person with us into those rocky waters. I don't know. I feel like I failed on a bunch of metaphors there, but anyway, I mean, that's my feeling about.
You mixed a lot, but it worked well.
Yeah.
I feel like I can't. Oh, no. I wanted to add something, and I think that it'll make you think of some really good puns. After RSA, there was this really interesting post. And it was by a man. And one of the things that he said that he thought was needed at RSA is he recognized that there was a need for more women in cybersecurity. And then someone responded to that post and said, actually, I felt like there were a ton of women there. And then I responded as a woman and I said, actually, no. I even went to a women's event at RSA and it was half men. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't have been half men in the room, because like I'm not trying to exclude men, but I think that there are instances where it's more important to have women together to bond, to be able to speak openly, and especially when they're on the same they're in the same career level and working towards the next level together. So Jamie and I have a couple of different groups like this where there are small groups of women where we're all around the same level and we're all moving towards a higher level together. And it's really fun because we get to celebrate the wins and we get to help out whenever, you know, things don't go the way that we thought they would. But I think that, and the interesting thing is that unlike Carol, all of my mentors have been men and continue to be that, which is why I thought it was really important for me personally to have a group of women who are in a similar situation so that we can have conversations. So does that help you think of
us? I'm so thankful for kind of having found the network. I feel like there are folks who kind of brought me in, like, and I was like, why did, like, you know, like I got invited to some cyber dinner at RSA, and I was like, oh my God, these women are like so amazing. But I was like, here I was like a different perspective. And I felt honored to be there. And there was this feeling of like being at peace there, because there are like women at all kind of, you know, mostly like, you know, mid to senior level. Some are moms, some are not moms. Like, and that's what I kind of love about being around women too. Like I appreciate the life paths that everybody's sort of taken. And I appreciate getting those perspectives too, because I feel like it makes you a better professional to recognize like other people's like circumstances.
Yeah.
So I love it. I kind of hope that for, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for like young women. And I've mentored, you know, when I was a team lead, you know, I've mentored folks before. Nothing brings me greater joy than to like kind of see them succeed. Like maybe that's a little bit of a mom in me. But like, I like having these sprint discussions with like the 20 somethings. Like they're hilarious. Like there are a lot of things about Gen Z that definitely drive me batty. Because like, you know, my 13 year old Gen Z definitely drives me batty, but
I don't know what half the things they say.
Right. They don't, but therefore it's important to understand their generational perspective too, because it's like, you realize that like, you know, we need folks to like, we need privacy professionals. We need cybersecurity professionals. And, you know, I feel like women are very observant and they notice things. And I think that attention to detail was really important when you kind of go through these disciplines. So,
yeah.
But no, I feel like the network of women, whether sitting right here or like other groups has been invaluable.
Yep. I totally agree. I think the interesting thing is that I'm actually thinking back to RSA. I was in a lot of meetings and there was only one meeting where there were more women than men in that room or in that meeting. Right. And by the way, for the credit of the federal government, it was the U.S. federal meeting. And I will say that the government has done a really good job to like advance women. And luckily, all three of us have been able to work with government. So we have been in those situations. But today, generally, I think all of us, I might be wrong, but I think all of us are generally one or two women in a room full of men.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. In fact, that's so funny because it reminds me of my first meeting at OMB. So my only experience in government had been in uniform where I was in the operation shop because that's where chemical ends up sitting. And so like, I was often the only woman in the room, in that unit, at times, but it never felt uncomfortable. There's this bonding and like, that you get with the military. And so there were certainly challenges that were presented by that though, with certain colleagues, but like then my first role on the non-uniform side, with a major, major company, I almost didn't go to that meeting because there was a side meeting happening. I almost got up and left, but one of the senior male staffers, he grabbed me and was like, nope, sit, you're staying here. And even though I was the most junior person on that trip, he was like, stay here, because as we walked in, he noted earlier than I did that there was not a single woman around this table. There were like 20 executives from that company, and the only females in the room were at a different table and the ones offering for us coffee. And they were, of course, wonderful and kind and great, but like that was a problem. And he saw and was like, nope, the government's going to be the ones to show that there's a woman here. They don't need to know that you're the most junior person on this like meeting. You need to stay and show this. And yeah. I wasn't the one who noted it. He was like, we're going to send this message. And I was like, that was really impactful to me. I hadn't been looking through that lens, and that was really eye-opening.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. All right. Well, I'm almost done.
I'm finished. And I'm going to
read off. Yeah. Carol's about to be done. So thank you so much, ladies, for joining me.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great night.